will be protected by approximately 20 dB of conducted interference. Is that what you're saying, Steve? How expensive is that particular item for the first 15 amperes? Over to you, Mel. Here we go, Glenn.
Well, they vary a bit. I mean, you can look it around a lot of these line filters that are available, and they're usually transparent. In other words, not only do they prevent noise coming from the line, but they also prevent your device from putting noise back out into the wall outlet conducted. And I've seen them vary from anywhere from like $10 to a few hundred. And a lot of them depend on the power level. You know, if you need like a 15 amp one, the higher the currents, typically they'll run closer to the $100 area. For just maybe a couple of amps, you know, you can find these things for like $10 or less. So, I mean, they're available. They're all over the place. As a matter of fact, even if you have a high-definition TV set today, one of the things that they recommend is that you put one of these noise-canceling filter strips, and they have power strips that have filtering built into them. And I think, you know, depending on where you buy them, they can range from anywhere from like $50 to, you know, like $150, something like that. And basically, it'll take any lines or any problems that you have out of your TV out. But it's the same idea here.
Okay, I like the sound of that. And if that fixes the problem on some of his customers, guarantee they're going to be very happy with him, as opposed to him giving them the news that you got to rip out all of that brand new recessed lighting you just put in there. K2KEY, K2RIW, what would you do in this case, Mel?
Use a Thurman. Thurman makes power strips, very expensive. It does a good job, Dick. I have them on my repeater systems.
What was that brand name, Howie?
Thurman makes power strips for the DJ industry. They come with voltage readout. They give you line conditioning. They have 8 outlets. They have a built-in circuit breaker. They're all about $350. It's called a Thurman.
Can you spell that name? Squeeze the mic, hold a second, then spell the name so that we're really hearing it. Over to you, Howie.
I don't know how to spell it. Thurman. I think it's F-U-R-M-E-N, Thurman. They make power strips. They run about $350. They have LED readouts. They have voltage meters. It's a nice power strip. It's about $350, and they handle 20 amperes continuous.
Okay, that's a possible suggestion. Mel, wait for the beep, and you got it.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I'm reading the book here from the ARRL, who have done really quite a chapter on this, on AC line problems. And here they show you about whether the line noise coming from fluorescent lights, electric water heaters, office machines, air conditioning, ventilation, thermostats, different types of situations. And there's a company that makes filters for the individual situation. In other words, if you have a lighting fixture that is creating the problem, they have a special filter that fits right into it. I mean, you can use, you know, Howie says line taps, but you can't plug your lighting into that. I mean, this is lighting that's built into, I assume, into the ceilings and places like that and all. So this company that they recommend, that, I mean, let it drop. Okay, they specify here, you have to specify, you know, what your problem is. According to the ARL here, yeah, when you contact the company, you ask, you know, you tell them what piece of equipment is the offending unit, and they make, I don't know what these devices cost, of course, or pan, but it's called Electromagnetic Filter Company. That's the company, Electromagnetic Filter Company. In the ARL, they show you how they tested it with spectrum analyzers under all different types of situations, Dick, over.
Hey, Mel, that sounds awful good. Steve, instead of you giving your client, your customer, the bad news that, hey, all that beautiful, expensive equipment you just installed, you're going to have to rip it out. And boy, you're going to be unpopular if you say that. And if you can find a solution of the line along the path that we're now discussing, I think you're going to become a hero. He spends another 5% of his funds, and 25 dB of the problem goes away. Boy, is he going to love you, and he's going to pass the word on to other people. KC2MDP, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. Yeah, that's good to know. Thank you, Mel. I definitely will order that book. It's a little late tonight. I'll order it probably tomorrow before I go to work. Yeah, it's good also to know that they commercially made these things. Like you said, I can't put something together and stick it in someone's house, you know. God forbid the place burns down and I find my homebrew filter in there. Well, you know what? That isn't going to look too good in my behalf. A wealth of information. I greatly appreciate all you guys' comments. I still am going to hook up my oscilloscope and play because it's just in my nature. And I'd still like to, figure out different kind of noises, you know, and everything else. That way I can actually walk into, any place, you know, that's got a problem there and diagnose this problem. And at least I'll gain some knowledge by it. Back to you.
Now, that's the right thing to do. To do the experiment, to look at various sources of noise, how many volts of extra glitches you get on your particular oscilloscope for your particular filter. Andy's environment is a beautiful one to start off with because his is more than above the alarming level, even though it's a commercially accepted, good brand, properly installed system, which probably is not too atypical from what an awful lot of homeowners and contract situations are running into. So please come back and let us know how it goes, Steve. You've got an interesting problem there. You guys just listened to TechNet number 1,298 of the series that began in September of 1982. Mel and I are going to officially sign off, and then we're going to pick up with Howie for a couple of minutes. 73-year-old, try to be kind to each other, and keep your curiosity, because that's where progress comes from, and keep seeking what is Mother Nature telling you in all these situations. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I just want to say goodnight to all. Well, we didn't pick up some of the other emails, but we've got to try to go through a few of them that some of them are very popular. Maybe that way it cut down the amount of emails, I guess. Yeah, they even tell you here about certain ones of problems, ignition systems from furnaces that cause problems. Oh, boy, they have a special filter for that. All right, we'll talk more about it in the future. 73 is all good night. K2KEY.
K2RIW, WD2HWW6.
Go ahead, Howie.
Quick question. I was looking at something on the Internet. There's a 10-meter loop antenna. It's 73, it's a rectangle, I think. 73, 73, 146, and 146. The question is this. They feed it with coax cable, 50 ohms. They claim that they have an antenna as a resonant loop that will give you under a 1.5 to 1 SWR. And I say a closed loop, a complete loop, DC, complete circle loop. And I say, how are you going to get a loop to match to a piece of coax? I don't think at any length that you're going to resonate that you can get that to give you the right impedance. Am I correct? Because it would be more like 300 ohms. Am I correct in what I'm saying, Dick?
Not necessarily, Howie. Any loop that comes even close to resonating, and it can be on the fundamental mode, the third harmonic mode, or whatever, there's a zillion ways you can feed between your coaxial cable and that loop to launch a signal onto that loop. You can do it by gamma match, T match, delta match, a small loop inside of the large loop. If you've got a smaller loop connected to your coax cable inside of the larger loop, and you have the ability to change the orientation, diameter, size, and series capacitor on that smaller loop, at least at one single frequency, you will get a one-to-one impedance match. You may not like the bandwidth you're going to get. You may not like the polarity that comes out of it. In some worst cases, you may not like the amount of RF energy that flows down the outside of the coax, but there's ways of solving that. But if you use all of the impedance matching techniques, even before you use an antenna tuner, right at the loop itself, there's a zillion ways you can feed a signal into a loop, and if you're smart enough, you can force every one of them, at least at one frequency, to be a one-to-one match. Now, Let me drop for a second.
Just no matching. If you got a minute, I'll give you the URL. I'll tell you where to look at it. I can't see it, and I'm just wondering how they can get a loop with no matching. It goes right to the coax cable.
Okay, are you telling me that you've got a loop of conducting materials, square, triangles, round, hexagonal, doesn't matter. Are you telling me there's an opening in the loop somewhere where the shield of the coax cable goes to one side of the loop and the center conductor goes to the other side, and they did or did not carefully adjust the exact length of that loop? Over to you, Howie.
It is exactly adjusted to a certain length. They tell you what the length is. This is actually on 11 meters, and I'm saying that you can't do that because it's either... maybe I'm wrong. They don't have any match network. Direct coax cable. Now, what I'm asking you, is there a frequency at which that's going to resonate and match with no problem?
EC2QIQ with a comment?
Glenn recognized. Howie, are you familiar with the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, Chapter 4 of any of the issues of the Antenna Engineering Handbook? Have you seen or have you heard about those curves? Over to you, Howie.
Long time ago, but you want to bring me up to date on it?
I'll admit that those curves are written for a monopole antenna in front of a mounted at right angles to an infinite ground plane. But these guys spent a man-year, Brown and Woodward, in 1947, measuring these curves. If you have the ability to change the length of a monopole, nothing but the length, and you're only looking at the resistive component, you can make the resistive component go from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms inclusive by changing nothing but the length of the monopole. I will admit that for most of those lengths, you're going to have a god-awful amount of reactive component left over. And by putting a series or shunt capacitor or inductor, you can completely get rid of the reactive component. So with nothing that looks like an impedance matching network, you make the length correct for a monopole and put one extra component, a capacitor or inductor, looks like there's no matching component there at all, matching network there at all, you can get a perfect 50-ohm match at least at one frequency. Now you're about to say, okay, if I can do that with a monopole, can I do that with a loop? In that same chapter number 4, let me drop, there's a whole lot of information as to what is the resistive component and what is the reactive component for various lengths of loop, and that's just for a loop that you make as a pure round loop. If you now give me the ability to make the loop other shapes, where I'm changing both the perimeter length and the shape of the loop, you're asking me, is there a combination where at this particular frequency I can get a match? I think the answer is 95% yes. I can't say I've got direct experience at doing that, but all of that previous experience in those areas I just told you about tells me that if you're smart enough, I think the answer is yes. Let's see what Glenn's going to say on this one. Over to you, Glenn.
The answer is 100% absolutely, positively, yes, it will definitely match. And I know this from going back to when I was like 15 years old, and I needed to make my first antenna for like 2 meters. And you could take a clothes hanger, quite literally, and basically take it with an SWR meter and just keep on shortening and shortening it. And what happens, the impedance comes from a high impedance to a low impedance. If you make it too short, it'll go too low, and the VSWR comes up again. You'll actually get something very, very good, a very, very good match with it. As a matter of fact, I had done that with a lot of different antennas, just playing around. Heck, I've even done it in EMI lab, where I didn't have the right antenna that I needed, and I had a piece of 50-ohm cable that I just needed to make a sniffer, and I had something that will measure impedance, so I could shorten the loop. So if you take a loop of wire and put it onto a network analyzer, and just sweep across it and find out where it's resonant, you'll find there's going to be a spot. And it's going to be that basically that length of wire, and you can cut it to length, and it'll be resonant somewhere. It depends on that length. Yes, Howie, absolutely, positively, you can do it. But it's the downside is it's going to be very narrow in frequency. Why do we do it at 300, 400 ohms, and then feed it with ladder line? Basically because you get much broader impedance, and you can use it for multi-bands. But if you just need one frequency and you need a piece of coax and you want to connect it up, for a narrow band frequency? Sure, why not? It works. Let me pass back to Dick first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Tell them about all the loops I made.
And Walt, isn't that a balanced antenna going into an unbalanced feed line?
No, it isn't, Howie. It isn't. It's actually a, that antenna right there is an unbalanced antenna running into an unbalanced feed line, basically because you're tuning that resonant impedance right at that, right where that antenna terminates, at the end of that coax. So if you're getting a good VSWR at the other end of that, of the 50 ohm coax, you're good to go. Let me pass it back to Dick first. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2KEY.
Yeah, in your particular loops, Mel, were they multi-turn loops? And what were you using for an impedance matching network, if there was one? Was there a situation where nothing but a single loop directly connected to shield and semiconductor of coax gave you a good match, at least at one frequency? Over to you, Mel.
Mel, we discussed this in detail. The ARRL book has that one, that's the one standing there, that guy who built the one for 160, and he has his wife standing there. You saw that picture of it. You know, we discussed it in detail. And I made one for 75 meters because I told you to try with the noise so I could phase the noise out. Amazing, with a QRN squasher and this thing, I could phase the noise out. But what I did is, yes, it is very critical. You have a variable capacitor on there, so you could, you know, move off frequency any amount, any of 2 kilohertz, and boy, you got to make the, you know, complete readjustment. But I did try transmitting into it at very low power to a local, and son of a gun, he heard me as well. He says on that is my big outside 275 feet of loop pick over.
That doesn't surprise me. Loop antennas can work amazingly well, even at super low frequencies. And it seems to defy ordinary theory. How in the world can that antenna have a reasonable amount of gain and a reasonable amount of effective capture area, if that's what that gain is telling you, even though the effective radio area of the antenna may be a tremendous number of times bigger than what your eye sees when you see that loop? Loops are very misunderstood, have a lot more capability than people know about, and that poor antenna has been maligned for years, and it doesn't deserve it. So I'm beginning to think the answer is probably yes, sir. Howie, maybe it's time you actually build one and see how it measures on your particular equipment. Over to you, Howie, KQRIW.
I have one other thing to share with this as well, if you have a moment for me, but let Howie go first.
Dick, because I can't see it, I can only read the words. It's, just go to Google and type in 10-meter loop antenna, 10-meter loop antenna, then look down where it says 20 over S9. It'll give you a whole bunch of things. You just go to Google, type in 10-meter, 10, M-E-T-E-R, loop antenna, and then go to where it says 20 over S9. And it talks about 10 meters for hams, and it shows this antenna. Go ahead, Dick. And does anybody know what approximate length would be of a loop, what the formula is for it to be around 50 ohms? I know what it is for 300. It's 1,000, you know, it's 1,005 divided by the frequency. So anybody know what the formula is? Is it less than a full wave for a 50 ohm impedance? Go ahead, Dick.
In the ARL book, under that chapter with the loop.
This is my turn.
Yeah, they, so apparently the book...
Mal, Dick, if you look at that, if you Google 10-meter loop antenna, and then you go to 20 over S9 under the, you know, the categories, they show you this antenna. Tell me what you think, because it's hard for me, somebody try to explain it to me, and it's hard for me to visualize it.
Okay, maybe I'll get a chance to look at that. Glenn, go ahead.
It's funny how you bring up the 10-meter antenna, because when I was a kid, I think I was like 12 or 13 years old, there was a very, very popular antenna out for CB radio called a Moonraker. It was a four-element quad antenna, and basically it was set up with, you know, a gamma match and a whole bunch of other things. Well, a friend of mine had one of these antennas, of course a windstorm caught it, and this thing got really, really banged up bad. So what happened was he took off all of the... all the other elements that were, you know, the driving elements, and basically all he really had left that was working was the wire reflective element on the back. What we found out was by just attaching coax to it and shortening it, we were able to get it resonant. And the funny part was, the antenna, just as a single round element, vertical in the air like that, it was able to transmit with as much side lobe gain as the Moonraker did with four sets of quad elements. So it was extremely directional, but on both sides as you turned it around. So one of the interesting things we found is when we just shorten the loop like that and tune it into a piece of coax, it becomes highly directional and very narrow band, unfortunately. And to give you a rough idea of what the length should be of a regular loop, it's about 70.7% of a full wave loop. We'll give you a 50 ohm match. The bad news is, yeah, you'd like to cut that one, that match, and hopefully it works, but I think what you're going to find in practice is that it's a kind of a critical measurement, so that when you get close to about 70% of the full loop, you're going to have to really, really trim it a lot, because in order to get it on the frequency that you want. And the other thing is, I think also if you see a lot of weather change, the impedance on it might shift around a little bit as well. Let me pass back to K2RW, KC2QI2.
Bernie recognized, but extremely noisy. More noise than audio. I went to that 2009. I see the antenna. It is a square loop, 146 inches, it says feet. No, 146 inches on the vertical side, 73 inches on the horizontal side, fed directly with a piece of coax cable at the center of the bottom, 73-inch dimension at the bottom, semiconductor and shield. The coaxial cable leading away from it has a three-turn loop of the coax as an RF choke. So in other words, that thing apparently does launch current into the shield of the coax cable, and they created an RF choke there to eliminate that. And so this antenna, the 2009, is apparently an article by 9M2MGL. His blog is where that is. I think the possibility exists, Andy, Howie, that could be a real antenna. I think that might not be a nut paper. That might really be a 10-meter antenna. Over to you, Howie.
Hi. If you make a loop horizontal, if you were to take what the other station was talking about, if you made it a horizontal loop, you made it looped, and you made it, and you paired it with 50 ohm, it would actually radiate in all directions, correct, Dick?
No. Every loop that you make, say for instance a halo, a 6-meter hula hoop or 6-meter halo antenna, has a slightly directional pattern, and it had a great big loading capacitor. Only when the loop is small compared to a circumference of a wavelength, so that the current around the loop is nearly equal, then it is an omnidirectional, horizontally polarized antenna. When it loop is parallel to the ground. As the loop gets larger and larger in circumference, it starts picking up a directional pattern. It is a kind of a curved dipole, if you know what I mean. This particular antenna is fed at the bottom. It is a vertical square loop. I say that is a horizontally polarized antenna, most likely. Bernie, you want to make a try? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, good evening, Dick. I just wanted to ask if you could take a moment to just say a brief word to some of our visitors from all around the world. Are you reading me okay now?
Yes, Bernie, I'm reading you very well. For those who are listening to this tail end of 4.5 hours, this is the Technical Net on Long Island, the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. This particular technical net has been in existence since September of 1982. It covers the tri-state area of northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, and southwestern Connecticut. This particular repeater has reasonably good coverage in that New York City area of the United States. I'm K2RIW. The other guy, my name is Dick. The other guy you hear, who are in net control, is Mel. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. This net used to be a one-hour net 27.5 years ago. Because of its popularity, has slowly crept up to 4 hours worth. These guys with all this brain power in this metropolitan area of New York City area of the United States, we get together every Sunday night starting at 8 o'clock local time We discuss our favorite subject, ham radio. For the most part, let me drop. For the most part, there is no planned subject matter. And we're very different than other nets. We don't start off saying, is there any emergency traffic? That's a ridiculous statement. I don't know why people do that. We only have sign-ins. We request sign-ins from the people who have a real question or a comment for the net. We don't sit around with a long list of people saying, I'm listening. After 27 years, we accept the fact that people are listening. And as I said, there's a lot of brain power in the New York City area. These people who are the scientist-minded type of ham radio operators get together, and then we dig into our favorite subject, the 27 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. And we discuss anything from transmission lines to favorite transmitters to favorite antennas and how propagation works and moon bounce and meteor scatter and whatever, the 26, 27 different kinds of ham radio. We dig into it. The biggest complaint people have is that we're too verbose. We dwell too long on each subject. Well, everybody else can do it super briefly and leave a lot of confusion. Whenever I ask the question at the beginning of these nets, do you want the long answer or the short answer? Do you want us to be brief or verbose? And the usual answer we get is, please be brief as you can, but when you get to my particular subject that I signed in for, please give me the whole story. So we slowly concluded that although we're going to make some people unhappy because of the length of time we dwell on a particular subject, we still manage to find out something that hasn't been discovered before, and a heck of a lot of people go away happy. As I said, this net has slowly developed into 4 hours worth. Tonight it's into its 4.5 hour. This is net number 1,298. This particular net has run for approximately 27 and a half years. This is the 3,800th hour of this technical net. So although some people are unhappy, you can never please everyone, we think we're serving a purpose. We think...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
We think there are more people that are pleased than displeased. But occasionally there are people who are displeased. We sort of accept that. You can never please everybody. And we're not 100% accurate. Nobody bats 1,000. But we're objective enough, we think, and realistic enough that when we find the errors, we admit it and go on from there and consider it a learning curve. So that gives you an extremely brief thumbnail sketch as to what is the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club technical net. As I said, 27 and a half years. Is that some of what you were looking for, Bernie? K2YO, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you for that. I am hanging out with the folks on our EchoLink conference. So far, I've seen stations sign in from Taiwan, Australia, Jeddah by the Red Sea, England, Germany, Indonesia, Kentucky, and California. The feedback has been very positive. They're currently typing in, thank you, Dick. They very much enjoyed it, so they're giving you their positive thumbs up and looking forward to more of it. So I just wanted to pass it on to you and let you know you've got a lot of friends out there that they can't necessarily transmit due to the extreme delays. By the time the electrons work their way around the world, but they are there and they are listening. K2YO.
Okay, very impressive. Thank you for that information, Bernie. And with that many people listening and that far a nation, I guess we better be a little bit careful with our language. For instance, when we describe the color code and the usual profane way of measuring remembering the color code, I guess we got to be careful. Okay. We should have stopped at midnight and 4 hours of technical net every single...
Hey, Dick, you have time for one more question from me?
Not really, but go ahead, Glenn.
Just a funny thing I noticed with loops, that, taking these shortened loops where you feed them into a piece of coax and you get a resonance. Okay, I can kind of understand or buy why you get a resonance with the loop and a length of coax. And yes, you can tune a narrow band lobius that you are at the end of the coax into a loop and get a fairly decent performing antenna. But now here's the funny part that really kind of amazed me. A couple of times I've made these measurements on medium-sized loops, things no lower in frequency than 10 meters, but I should try it on the bigger ones too, where they're fed with a piece of coax, and there's more than one resonance. So you'll have a resonance at one frequency, and then as you go up in frequency, you may find that there's other bands that this thing has got a narrow resonance on many, many times going up the band. Do you have any idea why that might be? I sure don't.
Explains it in the article here in the book.
There is a logical answer and a slightly illogical answer. I'm doing some work right now on an antenna at a UHF frequency where I need a lot of bandwidth. And I set up this antenna and the feeding mechanism, and it's being fed with a piece of coax cable, and right now there's no ballon on that coax cable. And as I sweep it over a very wide frequency range of a couple of octaves on a good, well-calibrated network analyzer, a Rodin-Schwarz network analyzer, I find the primary resonance I expected to find, and I find two or three more resonances. As I grab the coax cable that's feeding the antenna, a number of the other resonances change in S11 magnitude and frequency, so that I know that some of those modes of resonance are the antenna itself, some of those modes of resonance are launching currents into the outside shield of the coax cable that's feeding it. And so where this particular 20 dB over 9 antenna for 10 meters has you put a loop of coax cable a number of turns to act as an RF choke right at the antenna, I have partial understanding of what's going on. So that's some of what's going on. Let me drop. I'll recognize, I'm going to give it to you in a second, and that is, as you sweep over enough frequency, you'll be amazed how many modes of frequency resonance are there that you didn't plan on. And an antenna will radiate if energy is able to transport from point A to point B within your antenna, and if the bouncing of that energy within the antenna finds a way of staying co-phase, in step on each individual bounce, even if it's the second, third, or 17th harmonic. If there is a way that the energy can bounce from point A to point B within your antenna and stay in phase from cycle to cycle, it is, by definition, one of the resonance points. So when you study hard enough, the networks that we build that look simple on paper, when you go to a high enough frequency, there's lots and lots of modes that it can find. Parallel modes, common modes, and differential modes. Over to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now this is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm just looking at the information that you're just conveying. For instance, you must stay within 0.1 wavelength of that frequency for the loop to work properly. For instance, a 160 meter loop, one operating at 18.8 megahertz, is approximately 20 feet in diameter, 5555, makes it into a square made out of coax, and it comes out to 0.037 wavelength. The reason I picked this is because the capacitance per foot of the cable winds up to 21 pf, so that the total distributed capacitance is 420 pf, and this makes it then an additional 100 pf will be used as the resonant to resonate the loop. The loop winds up at 15 microhenry. So, by doing it with this method, he shows that you will be able to get a lot of different spots on different bands where this loop will resonate. And I this is the one I built, and it surely is. I found this goddamn thing was resonating all over. I find spots I was playing with, and it would pop in and all.
Jay, to comment to that?
Your conversation did stop very abruptly there, Mel. So maybe you let go of the mic. I'm not quite sure, but about 15 seconds ago, it stopped very abruptly. Go ahead with your comments, Glenn. And by the way, I'm going to have to leave you guys because, believe it or not, I got to go to work tomorrow. And this is way beyond the bewitching hour for me. You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I think there's something so valid to what you're saying about the reinforcement of the antenna and eventually find an area of resonance. Because even though, like what you're thinking, is like originally when you draw this out on paper and you look at the inductance of the loop and you say, okay, there's some parasitic capacitance of the cable, well, that accounts for one resonance. but where are the other ones coming from? That's where it gets a little bit of mind-boggling. And you can say, okay, there are going to be other resonances, but they're going to be at different impedances. Okay, so you wouldn't expect them to be 50 ohm resonances. And they are. There is something a little bit more going on there, and I think that Dick has probably nailed something there where basically there's a reinforcement that basically because the signals are moving in, up and down and back through that cable, that eventually there's going to be another point where it reinforces back at 50 ohms again, just due to the geometry of the antenna and the signal running through it. Mind-boggling stuff. So let me say 73 is Mel and Dick, and have a good evening all. This is KCQ, QIQ, 73.
They explain it. If you want to look at it, if you can get a hold of the 19th edition of the Antenna ARRL Antenna book, you want to read about the loop, it's all in there and why this happens, and they tell you about how it exhibits different amounts of capacitance per foot when in this type of configuration and how it will establish different feed points, establishes different feed points to obtain resonance at different places. And they give you a lot of formulas and things. Very interesting reading, going over.
WB2HWW. Dick, thank you very much for the explanation, because obviously it's hard for me to visualize it.
Howie, like I say, I have built this loop exactly, and it works on 80 meters. I can tell you this goddamn thing will work. So I built another version of it for my friend. We built it out of copper for 20 meters because he lives in a city. And be amazed that, in fact, we even homemade a variable capacitor by using two pieces of pipe adjacent to each other. So it's amazing that it works phenomenally well. I never expected it, how it works as well as it does. Over.
Yeah, I'm going to add one of the...
I gave you my phone number. Can you give me a call sometime tomorrow or during the week?
Are you directing that at me, Howard?
Yeah, I am. I'm going to give you... If I gave you my phone number, can you give me a phone call?
I may get home a little late tomorrow, but is it okay to call you, say, after 9?
You call me up to 2 in the morning. I really don't care. I live alone.
Get home late, I'll go in late tomorrow. See, I don't have to punch a clock. That's part of being retired. Okay, give me a phone call. I'll give you a call.
Yeah, 718-591-3678. Yeah, I'm just going to ask you a couple questions about some antennas, and I just need someone to visualize it for me. Because when you can't see, I'm trying to do something. And I'll discuss something on the phone with you.
Yeah, let me add one final comment here, and that is these resonances that Glenn is talking about that are confusing him, let me let a beep happen. There are approximately 5,000 kinds of antennas. You open up the latest issue, the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, a McGraw-Hill book by Mr. Volakis. And I think it's got something like 1,200 pages to it. You'll find out there's something like 5,000 kinds of antennas. That's a rough approximation. Is it 4,220 or is it 6,500? It doesn't matter. Approximately that number. And of all of those kinds of antennas, dipoles and loops and Yagis and Wallenwebers and horns and parabolic, it just goes on and on and on, scimitars and so on, blades, of all those kinds of antennas, you can break those antennas down into two types if you want to really be severe. The standing wave antennas and the traveling wave antennas. The traveling wave antennas are the ones that are many wavelengths long. Beveridge and rhombic are those. The RF energy travels down the wire once, hits the 600 ohm terminating resistor at the far end, and dies. And what radiation takes place in those multiple wavelengths of the antenna is all that you get. And the terminating resistor is only there so you get a good front-to-back ratio. It gives you some gain in one direction, some directivity, reasonable amount of effective cross-sectional area, fairly simple antenna, traveling wave antenna, signal goes down there once. Let me drop. But of all the 5,000 kinds of antennas, a very small percentage of them are traveling wave antennas. 90-some-odd percent, the high percentage of antennas, are standing wave structures. A lot of people hear those words and they don't know what it means. Standing wave structure means that within the antenna itself, once you get beyond the feed line and the impedance matching network and whatever, and the launching structure, within the antenna itself, the operating antenna runs at an extremely high standing wave ratio. You start off with your simple half-wave dipole, which has got around a 72 ohm impedance, and you feed it with 72 ohm twin lead. And at your operating frequency, you say to yourself, okay, that's a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on my transmission line. But in the antenna itself, within the wire of your dipole, it is a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. The energy is bouncing back and forth, the charge that you're putting in there with the feed line, between the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the dipole. It's bouncing back and forth. That RF energy bounces back and forth something like 20 times before it finally gets radiated. Radiation is hard. But a lot of people think that just because they got a 1-to-1 visoir, just because the energy flows down the transmission line once, they think that does the same thing with the antenna. If that was true, you could make the half-wave dipole any length you want, and you'd have the same visoir. You make it a little bit shorter or longer than resonance, and the visoir builds up real fast. That gave you a very strong clue. Let me drop. The very strong clue is it is a standing wave structure with something like a 20-to-1, more than 10-to-1 most of the time. The energy is bouncing back and forth a lot of times before that energy finally gets radiated. And it's not the electrons bouncing back and forth that get radiated. Not one single electron leaves that antenna. The bottom line of all this is that for any of the majority of antennas we use, you resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate. If you don't resonate, for all practical purposes, you don't radiate. And I'm talking now about antennas that have, let's say, more than 20 or 30% efficiency. To an electromagnetic interference person, where his definition of radiation is some signal sneaks out of the cable that's 60 decibels down because you've got a leaking connector, he calls that radiation. A ham radio operator using an antenna that's 60 dB below isotropic, he doesn't call that an antenna. That's a leaky dummy load. That's a cantenna that's got the, you know, that's got the lid slightly open, so to speak. So for the antennas that we really care about, you resonate first, then it has the ability to radiate. I'm very saddened to hear that not one single respected book I know about says those words. Those are very important concepts. Assuming that it's correct, I've been preaching this now for a whole lot of years. Very few people have given me any flack on it, so it could be a correct philosophy. And the reason you resonate is because if the antenna has an internal Q of 20, there's a 4 or 5 definitions of Q. Let me drop. One of the definitions of Q is the voltage rise at resonance. Another definition is the current rise at resonance. Another definition is the bandwidth divided into the center frequency. And another definition has got something to do with areas and losses and stored energy and so on. But let's talk about those first two. Let's talk about the second one first. The current rise at resonance. If my antenna is running with a loaded Q of 20, and many a half-wave dipole does that, that means somewhere within that dipole, the current that is flowing is 20 times higher than the current supplied by my transmission line. That's damn important. When the current is 20 times larger, and the current is creating a magnetic field, and the magnetic field of the dipole of the antenna itself is 20 times higher than the capability of the current flowing in the transmission line, if it was an open structure, and it's not, it's a shielded structure. But the fact that there's a 20-to-1 magnification of current, and therefore a 20-to-1 magnification of magnetic field, and that magnetic field, from many points of view, begins the radiation process. You go to any of your computer modeling programs, and you study what's inside of them. You'll discover that with the finite element analysis, they break up your antenna into a whole lot of little subcomponents, and they carefully calculate the current that flows in every one of those subcomponents. Then they figure out what magnetic field that subcomponent makes, and at some point and space a long distance away, they add up all those magnetic fields. From the analysis point of view of the computer programs you can lay your hands on, for the most part, they figure out what is the magnetic field due to the current flowing into the antenna and calculate the radiation from that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Assuming that that modeling technique works very well, assuming that that modeling technique works, you're now getting a clue as to why you will resonate first before you radiate. Radiation is nowhere near as easy as you think. Everyone says that I've got a one-to-one antenna, the signal flows down the transmission line, it goes into the antenna, and just simply jumps into space. Oh boy. It's nowhere near that simple. You have to kick that signal, that energy you're putting out of that antenna, you have to kick it in the tail 20 times in the row before it finally decides to leave the antenna and go out into space. And that's an ideal zero-ohm wired antenna dipole in free space, the most ideal conditions you can get. You still have to kick it in the tail 20 times before it finally radiates. And it takes resonance to get enough current to really get that process running. So the bottom line, once again, you resonate first, then you have the ability to radiate at the levels of efficiency that we care about as ham radio operators. It's time that some of the good books say that in very coded language, where they talk about standing wave structures and boundary conditions and whatever. They're saying it, but it's in such a coded language, the majority of us do not get the message. That's a strongly felt opinion. K2RIW, I really got to leave you guys, otherwise I'll have to have toothpicks holding my eyes open at work tomorrow. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW, clear and listening.
Yes, what about receiving? You don't have to resonate to hear well, right?
That depends on what gain you want. Because of the law of reciprocity, whatever characteristic you're in, let me drop for a beep. The law of reciprocity of an antenna is very well respected, and it says whatever characteristic you get on transmission, impedance, bandwidth, beam width, gain, polarization, front to back ratio, side lobe levels, all the characteristics you can measure on your antenna on transmission. Any reasonable antenna that doesn't contain an active amplifier inside of it, or a circulator, any nonlinear device, any reasonable antenna will have the exact same characteristics on transmission as on reception. Therefore, if your antenna is giving you a gain that's above isotropic on transmission, that's a fancy way of saying that its effective capture area on transmission was greater than 0.08 lambda squared. That's what an isotropic antenna's got. 0.079, I think, is the exact number. 0.079 lambda squared is the effective area of an antenna with 0 dB of isolation. By definition of reciprocity, it must have the exact same effective area on transmission as on reception. The confusing factor here is you can take a clip lead that's a crazy length long, connected to the center conductor on the UHF connector on the back of your HF rig, and you can listen to a signal on 80 meters. And signal-to-noise ratio sounds beautiful. The S meter doesn't move very far. What's going on there is your receiver is very forgiving. You can connect to the receiver a 500-to-1 standing wave ratio antenna that's got a few microvolts on it, and it's going to respond. But the S meter doesn't move as far as it would on a fully resonant, properly...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Properly operating antenna. That clip lead, you cannot transmit it to it. A 500-to-1, so to speak, standing wave ratio, your transmitter is going to go crazy. You can't pour energy into it. So that clip lead that's non-resonant, yeah, from an electromagnetic interference point of view, it radiates. It may be 30 dB lower than an isotropic, so to speak, if you don't impedance match it. And it does that both on transmission and reception. Because the noise at the horizon on 80 meters is so loud, you can have an antenna that's 30 dB below isotropic and still hear reasonable signal-to-noise ratio. So you won't get much S-meter deflection. But on HF frequencies, it'll work. VHF, it doesn't. A whole bunch of complicated reasons why. So the receiver is so forgiving to extremely high VISWR the dynamic range of your automatic gain control is so great, the noise in the band is so high, you can use a really yucky antenna for receiving on HF and get away with it, but you're not going to transmit into it. But the hard thing to believe is that crazy antenna you built that's too small to be half-wave resonant, but you forced it into resonance with loading capacitors, top hat capacitors, loading coils, meandering, putting it into a helical wound, whatever, let me drop. As long as you've used low-loss materials and you force it into resonance at your favorite frequency, it will radiate well, because all of radiation on reasonable standing wave structure antennas, which are 98% of them, so to speak, require resonance first to radiate well. I know this is not easy to accept the first time you hear it. It sounds like a religion, it sounds like a philosophy. I see a lot of evidence that it could be real. As I said, I've been preaching this jazz for 20 years. I haven't had many people tell me it's dead wrong. A hell of a lot of people have said, why the hell hasn't somebody told me that a long time ago? And why don't they... in any of the good antenna books? Looks like we've really...
Report number 1710 with a release date of Friday, May 21, 2010. The following 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Hemvention 2010 is a big hit. We take you there. Also, an IARU report says that Ham saved lives following the April earthquake. Kenya gives its hams expanded privileges on 40 meters, and supercapacitors may replace batteries in critical uses. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1710 coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now reporting from Mississippi, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
The 2010 Dayton Hamvention is now history, and by all accounts, this year's event was bigger than last, even considering the poor economy, as we hear from Henry Raminski, Hamvention's media and public relations chairman.
Well, things have been going pretty well. Flea market sales are above last year, inside exhibits are above last year, events registration was above last year, and the attendance seems to be reflecting that. It looks like we're going to have a better year than we did last year, for sure.
Pyle Sound's Chip Margelli, K7JA, echoes Henry's observations about the increased attendance at this year's Hamvention.
It's a little tough to know what to think here, because I haven't left the booth. It's been so busy. I don't know what the weather's like. I don't know if it's pouring down rain or if it's sunny, but
We've had a very good first day, but a great crowd. Everybody's interested in new stuff, and everybody seems to have a smile on their face, so there looks like everybody's having a good time this year.
Henry goes on to tell us that Hamvention is a lot more than just new toys at the vendors and manufacturers inside, and everything under the sun outside in the flea market. There's something for just about everyone.
Well, one of the things a lot of people are looking forward to, we're going to have a balloon launch tomorrow to take some video cameras up. It's going to have APRS on it so people can track it. It's going to go to about 100,000 feet before the balloon bursts and parachutes back to Earth. And I know there's a lot of interest in that. There are a number of other forums that also... Some deal with new technology, digital radio, things like that that people are interested in.
One of the best attended and most anticipated forums is Friday's Ham Radio and the Law Forum. Since 1980, James O'Connell, W9WU, has kept attendees abreast of the latest developments as they relate to covenants and antenna restrictions.
The amateur radio and the law, getting it up and keeping it up. 20 years ago, hams just put up a tower and no permit. Now, a lot of people will, you know, do some investigation on their own. They'll contact any one of the number of attorneys who are volunteer counsel for the American Radio Relay League to seek advice or how they should proceed.
If you're thinking about erecting a tower or large antenna, this is one forum you really need to attend.
Well, the real differences are that there have been some very clear statements from the FCC in regard to amateur radio antenna towers and I like to call them antenna support structures, where the commission itself has suggested that firm fixed height, 35-foot ordinance or 50-foot maximum, is illegal under the Communications Act and under their ruling in PRB 1, and there's been two or three subsequent rulings that explain and expand on it. So the FCC has, you know, given us a better weapon to use in convincing village or village officials that they need to allow hams to have a greater height for their towers in order to engage in communications.
Of course, it wouldn't be Hamvention without the Amateur Radio Newsline Town Hall meeting. Several hams, well-known and not so well-known, explained how your ham ticket could open the door to your next job. We'll have more on the town hall meeting next week. In addition to the Waxon dual band handheld we told you about previously, there were a number of other new products of interest to those strolling the display area at the Hera Arena. Among them, the long-awaited Kenwood TF-590S HF 50 MHz all-mode transceiver. According to Kenwood, the new radio features a 32-bit floating point DSP, advanced receiver performance, and an extensive range of features that make it ideal for beginner and seasoned DXer alike. The radio's exceptional ease of operation, true to the Kenwood tradition, will be especially welcome for contest and mobile operations. No firm manufacturer suggested retail price for the TS-590 was announced. But the TS-590S wasn't the only new entry from Kenwood. Also displayed was the company's APRS-capable CHD-72 144 and 430 MHz dual-band FM portable. Kenwood says that thanks to the internal GPS unit, APRS operations will be more enjoyable than ever. The CHD-72 also offers Echolink memory compatibility and a mini USB connector for enhanced computer connectivity. On the audio side, here's Bob Heil, K9EID, on his new microphone and headset offering.
Well, we've been working for about 2.5 years to develop a new microphone element for a headset. But I wanted this microphone element to be for the broadcast industry as well as amateur radio. Now, this was a real feat because we don't have very much equalization in today's transmitters, only plus or minus 5. And as you know, 5 dB is not enough to really do anything to change a microphone sound. Well, the new HC6 will become an HC4 on one side and dial it over the other, and it becomes great for broadcast. And so we can have the sound of a full range transmitter from a headset now, and that until now has not been able to be accomplished. So we're very excited about it, and it's in our new ProSet Elite, which is a very strong, stringent headset that we've developed, fiberglass reinforced, stainless steel, you know, the whole bit, really nice, strong boom. So we're very excited about the ProSet Elite and the HC6. And this just gives us a new microphone that matched the technology of all the radios from the late 97 all the way to the 9000 Yaesus. We've got all kinds of equalization and DSP. Now we have a microphone to match all of that.
Let me ask you, could that cartridge be used to retrofit any of the older mics?
No, it won't, but we're soon working on